What's it like to ditch work for a year and bike pack more than 16,000 miles across two continents? And what challenges, physical, mental, and animal, do you encounter along the way? I'm your host, Amy Bouchas, and on this episode of Outdoor Explorer, we chat with Anchorage residents and endurance athletes Ryan Fox and Katie Siebert about their year off of work cycling from Edmonton, Canada to the southern tip of Argentina with a side quest down the east coast of the Lower 48. We'll hear about what it's like to take on a big adventure, how to afford it, and the challenges of coming home. That's just ahead on Outdoor Explorer. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Amy Bouchat. Today, we're going to hear about a big adventure across continents, all of it by bicycle. Okay, so why don't you start by introducing yourselves? Just maybe give us a little bit of background about where you're from and what you do when you're not cycling across the world.
So I'm Katira Siebert. I work at Gladyswood Elementary School, and I do Ironman triathlons.
Yeah, I'm Ryan. So I did not grow up around Anchorage. I'm from originally from the East Coast, from Connecticut. And I moved to Alaska about 5 years ago, to Nome originally. I'm a teacher. Like Katie, I teach middle and high school, and also in the Anchorage School District. And I, like I said, moved to Nome 5 years ago. And 2 years ago, I moved to Anchorage. And we both right now live in Anchorage, Alaska.
And Ryan, am I correct that you previously worked at Skinny Raven as well? Do I remember that correctly?
I still work at Skinny Raven. Okay. So my side gig, so to speak, is, and I actually work there full time in the summer. So
awesome.
My side gig, yeah.
Okay. So if people weren't stalking you on the internet like I was and have not been your student, they may know you from Skinny Raven.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Awesome. All right. So, you know, it's a place people go. Okay, so both of you, as I mentioned, recently cycled basically across the world. And that's what we're going to talk about today, that awesome adventure that you had. So maybe just give us a recap of your trip, just like big picture. What was it? Where did you go? Where did you start? What happened?
Yeah, so Katie and I set off a little over a year ago in late May of 2025. From Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And we bicycled first to New York, about 3,000 miles to the east, and then bicycled all the way from New York to the southern tip of Argentina in Ushuaia, at the very bottom of Argentina, Patagonia. And we did that over the course of about 11 and a half months of elapsed time. We weren't on our bicycles for every single day, but yeah, it was about, we finished in early May of 2026. So late May of 2025 to early May of 2026.
And Katie, how did you get roped into this? Was this your idea or were you?
So originally we were thinking about going and teaching in New Zealand and teaching abroad for 2 years or a year. But then we were looking at how much you get paid in New Zealand, and it's pretty minimal. And we realized that we would come out with about the same amount of money if we bikepacked in South America and got to explore several countries. So we decided to do that instead.
So wait, you would make as much money in New Zealand as you would come out with if you biked across the world?
So we, South America, because we did the cycling trip very cheaply, we wouldn't have had much of a difference in income had gone to New Zealand because of the moving cost.
Oh, okay.
To get to New Zealand.
Yeah, basically we still would have been like net negative if we had moved to that country and worked for 2 years, and we would have been like net negative around the same.
Yeah.
So we decided we'd rather, if we're going to take a couple, you know, some time off from Alaska, why not just do it as an adventure versus
working.
That's crazy. Indeed. Why not? Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. That's wild. Okay. So you said you did not cycle every day, but you cycled almost every day. Do you have any tally of how many days in that 11 and a half months you were not on bike?
Yeah. So we bicycled for 262 days out of about 330 elapsed days, or 335. So you know, that adds up to something around like 70% or something like that. And those days were scattered. We took a week off in Costa Rica. We took, what else did we take off?
We took a week off in Mexico, or we took
3
3 weeks
weeks off in
off in
Mexico.
Mexico. I had to go home to help my brother. And then we also took a where we would usually ride like 7 days and then take a day off. And then towards the end of the trip, it ended up being where we had to take 2 days off because we needed a day to do laundry. And then the other day, we would do some touristy activities.
Laundry and other chores. Like, we
Yeah.
didn't take an entire day to do laundry out there, but there was a lot of logistical things. So, like Katie said, like towards the second half of the trip, I'd say
Yeah.
is more like,
Because it was a little bit more difficult in the second half to be able to figure out where to get our clothes cleaned at and where to like stock up for the week and to do bike mechanicals. We had more bike mechanicals in the second half of the trip than the first half.
yeah.
About where did the second half start? Like when you're cycling from
Well,
Canada to the end of Argentina, what is the
technically
second half?
the halfway point for us, because we did like a weird like massive detour in North America, our second half was technically would have started in like Nicaragua, like southern Central America. But the traditional like halfway is when you reach the Darien Gap in Panama, which we did not bike over. It's a super dangerous.
We flew the Darien Gap to Colombia and
Yeah.
then restarted in Colombia.
So from like Panama City, Panama to Cartagena, Colombia, we took a plane and it was only like a 45-minute flight. It's very short. And you actually go north from P Panama City to Cartagena. So it's not really like skipping miles. And
Yeah.
the official Pan Am route actually dictates that you do that because of how dangerous it would be to cross the Darien Gap. There's no roads, it's controlled by drug traffickers.
Yeah. Sounds like a good way place to stay away from. Yeah.
Yeah.
To avoid.
Yeah.
Okay, and why did you have more bike mechanical problems the second half? Like just your equipment was like, we're done.
I think it was a little bit more difficult to get quality equipment in South America than it was in the US. The gear was definitely cheaper in parts of South America, but it, like the top like we and some of the roads were a little bit more rugged than the United States. So I think that all played a part.
Yeah, like we would buy like so it, we also both had like new bikes. Well, actually, we didn't have. I had a new bike, and Katie had a bike that was actually given to her by a friend when we started. But both the bikes were in pretty good shape at the start, and then it wasn't until like South America that well, Katie had a new bike in the middle of it. But but
Yeah.
even so, like it was still like we were just going over, especially in Peru, like really rough roads. Like lots of potholes, lots of very sharp ups, very sharp downs in the Andes. And the gear that we were getting at bicycle shops was just kind of a bit shoddy.
Yeah.
So.
Wasn't the best year.
Are there a lot of bicycle shops? Like, is the cycling ubiquitous in that part of the world?
I would say that there are definitely cities that have a lot of bicycle shops.
Yeah, I think we were pleasantly surprised by that. We kind of expected to not have much in South America and Central America, but I mean, bicycles are such a cheap form of travel in most of the world. And I think we were always pleasantly surprised that even in like some of the smaller cities and even some like large villages that we rolled through in rural Peru and Colombia and Ecuador, that we would find bicycle shops. And some of them were really small and you know, they really could just do mechanical work. They didn't have like too much stuff, but honestly, we were pleasantly surprised by how much.
By how many shops there were.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many miles did you go?
I would say 16,500, but
I
I feel
think
like Ryan has a different
no, that's
estimate.
actually Katie has it exactly right. It's about 16,500. As you mentioned earlier, I did record every mile on Strava. Basically, there would be some random moments where we'd be riding for an hour or two. I'm like, darn it, I like paused my Strava and I forgot to
The
like you know
worst.
resume it, you know? So there might be some awkward, if you look at my like heat map, there might be some awkward little gaps, but pretty much every mile was recorded. And that's about like 9,000 miles in North America and about 7,500 miles in South America.
And what was an average distance day for you?
We would typically bike 70 miles, and then if we were having a good day, we could hit 100.
Yeah, 60 to 70 was pretty average. And it varied vastly by where we were. So in Canada and the US, like 60 to 70 miles. Sometimes, like Katie said, we would do 100 in North America. But in like Peru, we were doing like 40 a day when it was lots of climbing and the weather was rough.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your get ho nah. Let me redo that. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz, and I am talking to Ryan Fox and Katie Siebert about their adventure cycling from Canada to the end of Argentina over the course of 11 and a half months. Okay, so earlier, Katie, you said that this was sort of born of you wanted to go to New Zealand and have a couple of years just out of the country working and realized that it was going to like net gain the same amount of money if you just didn't work for a year and cycled across South America, but that's and Central America, but that is like not, I don't think that's something that would just occur to most people. Like, oh, let's think about it that way. So you're gonna have to tell me, like, how did this come up? Like, how did this whole thing get started?
My family thought I have always wanted to live abroad. It's always been one of my biggest goals. In college, freshman year, I attempted to study abroad and it just didn't pan out. And then college, I attempted to teach abroad, but that also didn't pan out. So the minute I got back to Alaska, I knew that I wanted to go teach abroad. But my family was like, you have to get vested, you have to work for a little while first. And so I started working. Vesting has been like your guaranteed employment after 5 years. And so I worked for 4 years, and then I met Ryan. And Ryan is a huge bicyclist. He loves to ride his bike all over the States. So he's pretty smart. And so he was like, let me run some numbers. Let me actually look at this and see what makes sense for us to do for if we're gonna do something wild for a year.
Do you love to? I mean, you must love to ride your bike because you just did it for 16,500 miles. But before this, were you a major cyclist as well?
I love to ride my bicycle. It's my favorite activity.
Katie won't gas herself up, but she has done two Ironmans, and pretty competitively, I would say. She's done an Ironman about 12 hours, a little over 12 hours,
Nice.
which is
That's awesome.
really, really quick. And she's biked almost the entire Alcan. The entire stretch from Prudhoe Bay and all the Dalton Highway all the way to Fairbanks. So she won't say that herself because she's quite a bit humble, but she's a pretty serious cyclist and a way better off-road cyclist than I am. She's always mountain biking in the trails in Anchorage all the time.
Nice. Awesome. Is that so, Ryan, did you also go from down the Dalton as well as part of this, stringing things together?
Yeah, so Katie and I like separately have both ridden basically from the top of the Pan Am, Prudhoe Bay, to Edmonton in some way or form. Katie's done like technically like only I guess 90% of that. I mean, there's a couple miles she's missing, but I have a basically a direct red line all the way from the top to the bottom. And I guess I can get into this a little bit because it's relevant now. But we didn't start in Prudhoe Bay or in Anchorage. Anchorage would have been super easy logistically because
Yeah, we live here.
we live here, and actually a lot of people that do the Pan Am start in
Yeah.
Anchorage. So, and that would have been kind of cool to say like, hey, we just bike
We
from our
bike from
house
our house.
to like Ushuaia. But there was a few reasons that we both agreed that that wasn't the best idea. And I think the first one was that like once you've been on the Alcan, whether it's on a bicycle or in a car, you kind of like it's a very boring road after not very long time. And we both had already biked, like I said, the Alcan and Dalton Highway. And those are amazing roads in Alaska. And we love Alaska and the Yukon. But we wanted to do like new things and see new places more. And I'm from the East Coast, like I mentioned. And everyone I've known before the last couple of years lives there, all my friends and all my family. And Katie was very gracious and was down to bicycle all the way to New York Because we also did the math and realized that if we started in Edmonton and went south just from there, we would finish too early. Katie would argue that we still finish too early, but
Yeah, I wanted to be out
yeah,
until the school year started.
you wanted to still be out there now. But we went all the way to New York, which was like a 3,000 mile detour. So our route, like for a lot of people, doesn't make sense, but for us, it did because we saw a lot of people that I knew. Katie's got actually a lot of family in New York, so we saw a lot of like family and friends on the East Coast, which was really important to us.
It doesn't make sense. You're right.
It's like so out of the way.
It's very out
It's
of the
like
way.
3,000 miles adding on
Yeah. Which
for
is like, I guess fine if you're in a car, but is a
a
lot if you're human powered
bike.
adventure, right? Like, oh, it's just 3,000 miles. That's totally fine. What is like the typical route? Because this Panamera route is what that's called. Yeah, this is a thing. And you'll see people who are driving it, you'll see like adventure rigs here from Argentina, like, saying that they're on this adventure. You meet people who are attempting to do this. I think a few, gosh, maybe in like 2018, there was a guy around the valley who was doing it on a kick scooter.
Oh my
Like, yeah, you like
God.
meet people who are doing this, right? It's a thing. So, okay, so what is the normal route? Does it go through New York?
No.
No, so normally it's like a straight shot, like it goes through Baja, California.
Well, so in the States, so basically you do go from Prudhoe Bay down through Alaska. You take the Richardson, the Alcan. There's a couple routes you can do through the States, but generally one goes through like Washington, Oregon, and California, and then like Katie said, goes down the Baja. Most Pan Am cyclists do the Baja because it's a lot Baja Peninsula in Mexico because it's a lot more like tourist friendly than the area of Mexico that we went through. And then a lot of other people will go a little bit further east and go through the Rockies, go through Colorado, Wyoming, basically following the Great Divide or Great yeah Great Divide mountain biking route. And go into Mexico through Texas. So we, and it goes all the way. The rest of the route is basically what we did through all the Central American countries from Mexico and then down the spine of South America. Usually people don't go through Brazil, and Eastern South America because it's flatter and, like I guess objectively a little less interesting. So most people go through like Colombia, Ecuador, Peru and Chile, Argentina, in some way.
Okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah.
Where did you enter Mexico? You said it wasn't as friendly, so.
Oh.
We entered Mexico at Laredo. We had an interesting experience with a hitchhiker who was driving. It was really hot that day, 105 degrees, and we had about 20 or 30 more miles left to ride to get into the town. So we hitched, and two cop cars, when they saw that we were hitching, pulled up to make sure that we actually wanted to get into the driver's car, which we did. When we got in, the driver was telling us that he had been in Mexico before and had his kids and grandkids had been kidnapped, and that we needed to be extremely careful when entering Mexico. So Ryan was like, "Oh, it's okay, we're gonna enter in the morning." And the guy told us, he's like, "Well, that's when they haven't fulfilled their quotas yet. So they're gonna be extra on top of you because of that." For like the criminals, well, but we didn't, when, so that scared us. We were considering like taking a vehicle to get across, but we decided to bike, and we didn't really notice that much of any like problems with the general public.
Yeah, but that's scary.
It was a bit scary. I mean, and I want to clarify that like we the areas of Mexico we went weren't tourist friendly, but they were very friendly. Like people were, and that went through all of Latin America. Cars were a lot nicer to us. There's a greater respect for two-wheeled vehicles, whether they be bicyclists or motorcyclists or dirt bikes in Latin America on main roads. So like immediately after crossing the border, we noticed that trucks and cars were going around us like a lot with a lot more respect. And that was true basically the entirety of Central and South America. So we that was like a pleasant surprise for us.
And thank you for that clarification, because of course the average American tourist is picturing something very different than, you know, but
Exactly.
and that, I mean, that's true traveling through America as well, right? Like tourist friendly and like friendly are not the always the same not always the same level, but they're both important. So thank you for clarifying that. Did you encounter any, you know, that was sort of a boogeyman situation. Did you encounter any like for real danger on your way?
The biggest danger that was really danger was dogs. And it got bad. Do you want us to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I got bit actually in Costa Rica. And so we were staying at a hotel and cooking some meat off of our Bunsen burner. And a dog had like ran up and bit my foot. And I was panicking because I'd never been bit by a dog before and it like really hurt. So Ryan was like trying to like tell the hotel owner that it was unacceptable. So that which it, like you wouldn't expect that you'd go to a hotel and get bit by their dog, and the hotel owner had said that this happens like all the time, which is kind of odd. Like if it's happening constantly, like why isn't anything being done to like stop it?
And we were lucky because she got bit in Costa Rica,
Yeah.
which has eradicated rabies. But most of the trip were in countries that did have rabies, and the dogs were more of a problem. Even though Katie got bit while we were not cycling, most of the problem was while we were cycling, and we would just be on a rural dirt road, and a pack of dogs would come out of nowhere and chase us. And this happened on a regular basis, like all the time in most of Latin America. And I mean, it got to the point where we were freaking out. You know, we'd think that one of them was gonna like bite us or charge and force us to crash into a car. So we learned just to stop in place and to like hold our arms up like we were gonna throw rocks. Later in the trip, we did throw rocks, and actually, I hit a few dogs because it became really like it was just it was an immense amount of stress for us for a lot of the trip.
That sounds really stressful. I've been chased by, you know, regular Alaska dogs, you know, folks' pets while running, and it's just, I mean, it's incredibly stressful, and I love dogs, right? But I do not love being chased by dogs. So. Yeah, you can be a big old dog fan and not want to be chased or bit by a dog. Yeah. So earlier we talked about how you logged your entire trip on Strava and of course on Instagram as well. Did you any other social media that people might have seen you on?
Do you want to talk about Crazy on Bike?
Yeah, so we also wrote blogs every single day. Ryan was a
Okay.
little bit more meticulous about it than I was. And we would record what we were experiencing for the day on the blog on Crazy Guy on a Bike, which is available. You just type in it online and
Yeah,
it'll pull up.
it's a pretty archaic website. And like Katie said, it's called crazyguyonabike.com. It's not our website, it's like a platform, you know, for other crazy people like us that like to
I like to bike tour.
live on their bikes. And we both have a and I can give you the links later, but we both have a like a blog site on there, and we wrote a lot. I mean, you still wrote a
Yeah, I
lot,
still wrote a lot.
hundreds
I
of
still do
entries.
tons of entries.
I had one for every single day. Basically, we would both write like paragraphs about what happened. So Strava and Instagram on my end kind of gave like the snapshot of what was going on, but the real like in-depth was our writing on those websites. And and I'll just speak really quickly for, a lot of people will do vlogging these days and get stuff up on YouTube. And I am so impressed with people who do that, because the time that it takes, even if you don't have an editor, just to film this stuff, like, and still try to live in the moment is very challenging. I mean, we would often like sometimes go out of our way to take a picture, and I just can't imagine, well, I can't imagine, but it's very difficult to do that with video, like a long form video. So we didn't do anything like that.
Well, let's take a break here. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media, and I'm your host, Amy Bichotz. I'm speaking with Anchorage residents Ryan Fox and Katie Siebert about their nearly 1 year-long adventure cycling from Canada to the tip of Argentina. And we'll hear more about their amazing trip after this break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm Amy Bouchatz, and I'm talking to Anchorage residents Ryan Fox and Katie Siebert, who are back in Anchorage after spending nearly a year traveling by bicycle from Canada to the southern tip of South America. Okay, so you, just a little bit ago, Ryan was talking about living in the moment. So tell me more about that, okay? Like, how do you thread the needle on that? You are cycling 16,000 miles, and that's a lot of in the moments to be in. So talk to me about that.
Well, I will say it's not super easy.
I do not do well living in the moment.
Okay. What do you mean? What do you mean by that? What do you mean?
So like, you know, each day when you're on a bike tour is, especially this long, is something that I think you have to, like, there's something locally that you have to be excited about, right? So I'm a history teacher, I'm a geography teacher, I've taught middle school, and I'm going to be teaching high school this year. So I really like to learn about the places that we're traveling through. I mean, the scenery is beautiful, but I want to know usually the background of, like, are we passing by like a historical place? Is this like an indigenous important place in history, or a geological, you know, are we passing by a volcano today, which a lot of times in South America we were. So like a lot of times the night before our ride, I would be on my phone and I'd look at the map, I'd look at Wikipedia, I'd read some blogs of other cyclists on that same website, Crazy Guy on a Bike, and I would try to learn a little bit about where we were traveling through. We also talked to locals, which was a little bit challenging because our Spanish wasn't super great, and I can get into that later. But really, I wanted to appreciate the areas that we were going through as we went through them. And Katie, do you want to speak on that a little bit too?
I have a hard time living in the moment. So when we were on the bike tour, I kept thinking about like, oh man, I didn't sleep last night. What if I don't sleep tonight? How am I going to function? Oh man, this food tastes awful. Or oh man, like this food is amazing. And I would like think too far ahead, which can kind of derail you when you're like trying to accomplish a goal. If you're just focused on the goal itself instead of the process to get to that goal.
Yeah. And we both know of cyclists that have, like Katie and I are a lot more physically, like athletically minded than I think most cyclists that do the Pan Am. Like most people that do the Pan Am will take 2 years, which sounds even more ridiculous, but it's a lot more of a reasonable time frame to bicycle through these places and actually
see all of the touristy activities.
Yeah, or just like live in a place for a little bit longer, like as you do it. Like it's a lot more common. And these people are really using the bicycle as a form of transportation and not like the purpose, like the event itself. Whereas Katie and I are very like athletically and health minded people. Yeah. And we like seeing everything was amazing, and experiencing like
all the different cultures.
The culture was awesome, but the primary objective every day was we want to ride our damn bikes for like 8 hours a day. Like that's what we would like to do. Like we generally enjoy that.
Yeah. So you're not moseying, you're mission oriented.
No. Yeah. So we were very and to Katie's point earlier about food, like Katie is a lot more like health food conscious than I am usually. So she was a lot more intentional about, hey, we're going to go to grocery stores. We're going to go to tiendas, Spanish word for stores, and seek out the healthy food because it's very easy to eat like trash everywhere in the world. And on previous tours, I've basically just eaten out of gas stations, and we did not do that.
Yeah, we didn't do that.
That sounds like eating out of gas stations also sounds like a way to perhaps get a stomach virus in all sorts of places, including the US, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's probably good for your health. Were you ever very sick on the adventure? I think I remember reading that you were.
Yeah.
So I got really sick in Peru. We had stopped in a Peruvian town, and I had that night some sort of like noodle dish, and I was up the entire night in this like really rough hostel like environment. And I was up like vomiting and like on the toilet. And it was like a shared bathroom. So Ryan was like beside the bathroom stall, making sure that none of the drunk guys, because it was like a festival
It
night.
was a huge like night of like carnival or something, and there was like a lot of mostly men in our hostel. So I was like a bit overprotective, well, maybe justifiably.
Justifiably
So
protective.
yeah, and the next day.
And then the next day, I ended up riding 100 miles to be able to make it, which Ryan wasn't super stoked about because he was worried about being able to make it to that town with the 100 mile, like having to do 100 miles with the daylight.
Well, that's a yeah, I mean, there's a long story there, but basically it was we were limited on daylight. We're at 16,000 feet high at one point that day. So Katie was going like extra slow.
Because I'd been up all night sick.
So we had a little bit of like a fight argument in the middle of this barren, like high plain area of Peru with like zero people around, where I was basically like, you should have taken a van and like hitched a ride this morning because I think we might be stuck in the middle of the night in the middle of Peru, surrounded by darkness tonight, because I don't think we're gonna make it. We did make it. But I also got really sick in Mexico. This is well before Peru, but like shortly after we entered Mexico, we ate at a Chinese restaurant that was a little bit sketch looking. Like it didn't look authentic. You could kind of tell. And I consumed E. coli. I didn't know that at the time, but basically the next day we were riding, and we had to get to Mexico City in like 3 days because, like we mentioned earlier, Katie was flying out for a couple weeks to help with her family. So we were approaching Mexico City maybe like 3 days out, and I was really starting to feel like feverish and nausea. And I remember we stopped at like a taco stand, and I was just staring at the ground, and I was starting to feel like I was burning up. And we had to make an emergency pit stop at a motel that costed like $10. And we didn't we could barely speak Spanish at this point, so we ended up like getting an ambulance because it was so bad. I was burning up to 103, and I like was feeling just like the world was ending in this little motel. And we got an ambulance came, and Katie's like got the Google Translate out trying to interpret with the lady that's the medic. And we ended up going in this ambulance to this hospital that had one doctor for 50 patients. And long story short, we did make it to Mexico City through a series of very expensive rides. And I ended up going to the hospital three times to get IVs, and all the while I lost like a ton of weight, which I couldn't really afford to lose at that time, and I was very, very weak for several weeks.
You have now several times mentioned using Google Translate, but I think you also, I read somewhere that your Spanish improved a lot by the time you got where you were going. Talk to me
Spanish
about
is
that.
practical at this point.
I mean, Katie doesn't give herself enough credit. We both can speak Spanish enough to communicate with restaurants and hotels and hostels and and basic places, and have basic conversations with people on the side of the road. And part of the reason mine got a little better is because while Katie was gone and I was recovering from that illness, I was working, volunteering at a school, like a I got connected with a really small high school on the edge of Mexico City in a place called Chimalhuacan. And I was teaching English there for 2.5 weeks, and living with the principal, her family. And I would talk to them in Spanish every day at lunch after school. And I got like a lot of my Spanish got better there.
Well, I taught once upon a time taught English in China for 2 weeks, and my Chinese did not improve. So, but I So, I mean, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. I mean, that's true, but I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that you learn the language just because you're in the country. That that takes like work and focus and wanting to actually like wanting to do it, you know? Yes. Yeah. So that's bravo to you guys.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I want to circle back to your fight on the in the high desert, as it were, or in the wherever you guys were in Peru, because that's a lot of time. Like, it's a lot of time to spend with one person. Okay. So I was really wondering about this. Like, I don't know if I went on such a journey with my partner, if we would still be partners at the end. I'd like to think we would be, but that's a lot of time with a single person. How do you navigate that in a relationship and like still like liking each other at the end of such a big adventure?
To be honest, the interesting thing is I think what doesn't get talked about a lot is the after trip. Like, yes, the during the trip was like interesting, like going 90% of the time together. But I think it's also, I think it's almost harder for us like after the trip, because during the trip, you're just so excited. Like, you're meeting this huge objective. You're seeing this, all these different countries, you're waking up with the love of your life like every morning. But then like after the trip, like you come back and like you're like going back to work and you're like trying to figure your life out and you're doing like the adult things. And I think it's almost harder for us like now after the trip than during the trip, if that makes sense. The post-trip blues.
Yeah. And I definitely want to add in more for the trip itself and kind of to what Katie's saying. A lot of people, when they hear that we were on the road together for years, like they say what you say, like, oh, if my partner and I were doing that, like that would be crazy. But the truth is, I actually think Katie and I, well, first of all, our relationship strengthened like immensely. We had been dating for a year and a half before the trip, which most would say isn't a super long time to devote a year to someone when you've only known them for a year and a half. But you know, obviously our relationship strengthened a lot on the trip.
Yeah.
And part of the reason that it actually wasn't as hard, I mean, we definitely had fights, like, and at one point in Costa Rica, Katie was ready to get on a plane and leave. But honestly, especially in the second half of the trip, we got along basically every day. I mean, we had that one fight on the high plains of Peru. By the end of the night, we were joking around with each other.
Help each other, support each other.
And we also didn't ride alongside each other the whole time. In fact, most of the time, like I mentioned earlier, we were listening to music and podcasts and or just the birds, and we were a separate distance from each other. And in the US, sometimes that was several miles from each other. In Latin America, it was more like a quarter mile, or, you know, maybe within like sight, sort of, like we could kind of see each other. I'm a lot stronger of a climber than Katie is, so on climbs, I would usually get ahead and I would wait for her at the top. Katie's a lot better of a descender. So she could fly down the mountains a lot more than I can. And so sometimes she would go all the way to the bottom of the mountain and wait for me. So we weren't, I actually think it would be harder if you were in a car with someone, because we could.
Or a tandem bike.
Or a tandem bike, because we actually had a lot of time apart during the day where we weren't alongside each other.
Yeah. 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 And I'm thinking like most of the times if I'm mad at my partner while we're on an adventure, it's usually because I'm hungry or tired or sick or, you know, like just the normal stuff. Right. That is solvable. And almost always it's that I'm hungry. It really triangulated the problem. I need a snack, you know, but he knows that now. Right. And I know. And so he can help me. And I know that like whatever his problem is, right, like maybe he's hungry too, or maybe, you know, he's got a headache or whatever, right? Like, you know, we know that about each other. So I imagine that that's the same kind of vibe, right? Like you come to figure out the issues.
Yeah. Like one of the main points of contention for us at the beginning was it was sleep and figuring out how we were going to get it well.
Yeah, I need a really quiet environment to be able to sleep well. And so we had to like figure out like where to best camp and where to find like the best spots for me to be able to get a decent amount of sleep.
Yeah. And we had a lot of issues in
a lot of tritos in Arizona.
Yeah.
Getting like huge headphones and taking tritazone to be able to get decent sleep,
which is a sleep med.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz, and I'm talking to Katie Siebert and Ryan Fox about their adventure from Canada to the end of Argentina on bicycle. Okay, so when you were in, when I was following your, like the internet stalker that I am, following your journey in through primarily through Central and South America. Because if I remember correctly, you did a lot of like couch surfing in the US. So you did a lot of like just sort of roadside camping, for lack of a better description, that at least that I remember seeing, or maybe I thought that was so wild that I remember that part very vividly. But like, what are some of like the strangest places that you ended up camping? And is my memory correct? I'm sorry.
Yes. So I'll speak to this a little bit, and then I'll let Katie speak for a bit too, because this is a big component of how we made this possible on the budget we did. So, like you mentioned, in the US and Canada, we did do a lot of couch surfing. We did it through an app called Warm Showers, which is a cyclist network where you can stay at other cyclists. They don't even have to be cyclists, but just friendly people's houses. Sometimes it was, you know, just in their yard. Sometimes it was in a guest room. Sometimes it was on the floor of a wood shack. But that was like very easy in some ways in the US and Canada to figure out. Like, we only stayed in motels maybe five times in the 3 months that we were in the US and Canada. So that part was very easy. And in Mexico and further south, we stayed in a lot of hostels that were cheap. And also, just to go back to the US and Canada, we camped a lot as well. Like at least, you know, several dozen times, but it was more warm showers. And then in Central and South America, at first we actually didn't camp because we were afraid to, which we now know we totally could have. Totally could have camped in Mexico. It's very safe. But at the time we were afraid. And we would end up staying at like hostels, like really cheap.
$20, $10.
Like
bottom of the bracket, like wherever we could find. But we did have nights where we would splurge and spend like $40 or $50 or $60 to stay somewhere super nice.
Yeah, and we had some really interesting nights. Like towards the end of the trip when we were in Patagonia, we were hoping to stay at like a campground in Patagonia National Park, and we didn't know that it was almost closed for the season, so they had closed down the campgrounds. So it was awful day where it was like 40 mile an hour headwinds, and it reminded me of when I lived in Nome, because it was just barren of trees and looked like the moon. And we got to this little house visitor center that had one like college student like working it, and we were like, hey, like, is the campground open? Is it nearby? And the sun is going down and it's like 30 degrees out, and they're like, no, it's not, and there's no place, like no town for another 120 miles or, you know, 200 kilometers in that direction. So I ended up like, I was like, all right, I'm gonna figure this out. So I walked out, like I was like, Katie, you stay here. And I went down the road like 200 meters and found underneath the road, there's these circular, I don't know, I guess you'd call them like gutters or
like a culvert.
Culvert, that's a better word for it. So I was like, all right, this is gonna work. So we ended up like moving our bikes at like 9 o'clock at night to this culvert, and we slept, just threw our sleeping pads down and slept in the culvert. And I cooked on our little stove. And we found out the next morning that that's actually where pumas will store their dead carcasses. I don't know why the girl didn't tell us that night before, but we had a lot of nights like that. Do you want to say more about the night too? Yeah, I mean, one time we were in also in Argentina, and we had kind of, we thought there was a campground on the edge of the city, and there wasn't. And cities are actually more complicated to camp in than towns, because it's harder to find like wild camping.
Sure.
And there's less, it's just a lot more difficult. And we knocked on the door of this random stranger, because we saw they had like an empty lot next to their house. And it was this woman, maybe in her like late 30s. And she was like, oh yeah, you can camp next door. And she spoke in English, which was great. So she told us we could camp in the yard. And as we were setting up our tent, she's like, actually, you know, why don't you just camp in my yard? And then we went inside her house, and her daughter was like working on a science project for like of the planets. And we ended up like sitting with her daughter and learning about the planets in Spanish. And then we ended up like getting offered a meal. And eventually she was like, you know what, you guys can just like stay inside. Like, so like that was warm showers DIY. Like we basically just knocked on her door and she could have totally been like, you know, get out of here. So yeah. That was nice.
Yeah. That's awesome. What did you learn about other humans, on your trip as you were traveling the world?
What did I learn about other humans? I learned that there's a lot of different ways to live.
Mm.
We met a couple of different families where they would have a one bedroom house for like five people, but then they would have this like massive flat screen TV inside of their house. And so I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And they would like have this like fancy truck that they drove, but like they still like all slept in like five people in like a one bedroom house.
That's funny.
I thought that was really funny.
I think I learned that there's a lot of commonalities between different countries in the US that people don't realize. There was one moment in particular. We were riding in Nicaragua. It was actually right around the same situation that Katie's talking about. And Nicaragua was probably the poorest country that we rode through. Not the country as a whole, but just the area of the country we were in Nicaragua was very impoverished, and a lot of people without shoes and a lot of people without like proper housing and a lot of like spoiled food in a lot of the shops. But the one thing that even the poorest of people still seemed to have was a phone, was a cell phone. And I remember we passed by this guy who was like probably a teenager who was herding like cattle, and he had like tattered clothes on, and he was very thin. And as he was like herding these cattle that all, by the way, were super thin and skeletal, he had a phone in his hand, and he's like looking at videos on his phone. And I'm like, man, like, I don't know, you know, you could frame that as like, it's kind of a negative thing that we all have this, like, there's this like serious, like, media addiction. I wouldn't even call it just a phone addiction, but like an addiction to media. But it, that spans everywhere. And even in really impoverished countries. And it, like Katie said, like with the TV, it actually like becomes more important in some of these places than proper housing. And that might sound extreme, but from our experience, it was true.
That's what it was.
That's yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Katie, earlier you mentioned post-trip blues, which I think anybody who's done like a big, I don't know, big athletic, like Ironman or even, you know, marathon or anything that somebody, like a goal you set out to do, and then you finish your goal and you're like, oh my gosh, what do I do with my life now? Okay. But I can imagine that is so much more intense if you've spent 11 and a half months cycling across, you know, the globe. So how are you guys dealing? Are you experiencing that? And how are you dealing with it?
So I am heavily experiencing post-trip blues. I'm incredibly depressed. And my boyfriend is being very calm and very supportive, even though it's a lot.
I'm sorry.
And I'm trying to get into counseling to try and help with it.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, for me, like, so this was Katie's first, like, really long trip. I mean, Katie's done trips of several weeks before. Like we said, she's done the Alcan, and that was, like, a 16-day trip. But I have done trips of a month or longer five times before. And so even though I've never done anything this long, I've done stuff like really long before. And, so I'm not as hit hard with that this time. I mean, it's a bummer to see Katie, you know, go through some rough time, and I'm sure she'll get through it. But for me, it's a little bit less so just because, I've done the Appalachian Trail, Pacific Crest Trail. I've biked across the country 3+ times before. I've done this before, and I've had that before, which she's having, the post-trip blues, and it is really hard to get through because, like you said, like you have a mission for a year for us, and sometimes when you get done with it, it is like a, oh my God, like it's a vacuum, and that vacuum is easily filled with depression and just rough stuff if you don't automatically have like a lot of things to do right afterwards. And like Katie said, like we ended in early May, and our teaching jobs start in August. So that's a pretty long period of time to not have like our regular career starting. And I'm working at Skinny Raven. That's like my full-time job in the summer. And I also like have a couple running races that I'm training for. And Katie's getting you've got some stuff lined up too. So
I don't really have anything lined up.
I think she's a little hard on herself. But.
So you're going back to teaching full time. Both of you. When you get that lined in and you know, you're like back to that life pattern, how do you see adventure fitting into your life going forward? Like what do you hope is next?
I am afraid that we won't have many adventures left ahead of us.
I disagree with that. That's where we're kind of at a point of a little bit of disagreement there. So what Katie means is that like she's thinking in terms of like huge adventures, like what we just did. Obviously, as teachers, we have the summers off, and we'll definitely be doing lots of bike touring in the future probably in the States, because even though it is more expensive in the States, like technically, like we are able to couch surf a little bit easier. The logistics are easier. So we'll definitely do that in the future. And I think that at some point it would be cool to go international again and do a really big trip, but it's tough because it's only been 2 months since we just finished this one. So I think if you ask us in a year or two, that would be a little different, but Asia is a place that we'd like to go at some point. And how we do that is yet to be, we talk a lot about future stuff on a very, probably more than most people. And we talk like specific ideas all the time. So, if you check back in a year, we might have a different answer on that.
Awesome. Is there a place that you pass through that you particularly want to go back to? Since you are mission oriented and not moseying.
There's a lot of places we want to go back to. I would love to go back to Peru. I'd also love to go to Bolivia and go explore Bolivia. Not that we ended up going through Bolivia, but I've heard really great things about Bolivia itself.
Yeah, I screwed up, and we actually were supposed to go through Bolivia instead of Chile. But I lost our passports. My sister visited us in Cusco, and I accidentally I had these passports in a backpack, and she took it back to the United States. And basically we were able to ship the passports back to Peru, but the place in Peru they were shipped was near the Chilean border. So we couldn't, and the way it works is that like Bolivia is very high up in the mountains and Chile is down low, like most of the country is, or at least the road on the coast. So it wouldn't have made any sense to go back to Bolivia after going into Chile. So we'd love to, like, Bolivia has a lot of what we liked about Peru, but even more so. There's more indigenous culture there, which is really cool about Peru. Like the Quechua language was just so strong. That's their native language. In no other country was that really the case, where the native language was still existent in any strong form. And for me, like additionally, I would really want to see Ecuador again. We were in Ecuador, but mostly in the jungle part of Ecuador, not the touristy, like mountainous part. Like we didn't go into Quito at all. And Katie and I both love the mountains, and we love hiking in the mountains. We're doing that basically every weekend here. And I'd love to go back and run in the mountains of Ecuador. We just didn't get a chance to. We saw the jungle was still pretty cool.
Yeah, the jungle was cool.
The Amazon was amazing, but we didn't get to see what most people go to Ecuador for.
Okay, so maybe some folks who are listening to this are going to be like, wow, that's it. I'm leaving it all and I'm going bikepacking for a year. Okay, so if someone's listening to this thinking that they really want to take on this adventure or something similar to it, what is your advice for them?
My advice is to stop thinking about it and just go do it. Because, like, it can be, like, really scary to, like not, a lot of people are going to tell you not to do it. A lot of people are going to tell you that, like, you should save your money and
buy a house. I think Yeah, it's really, the voice is, do you want to finish?
I think it's really hard for people to go against the norm. And it's definitely, I don't think it's really the norm for people to like not work for a year and go bike tour.
And I would say, like, first off, that it is a lot more of a norm in places like Australia and Europe and New Zealand. Like, we met a lot of people around our age that were doing something similar to us, but it's a lot more common over there to take more time off. And we were blessed that we've worked and saved money for years.
For 4 years.
And lived fairly frugally. Katie still lives with her folks, and that saves a bunch of money. And I've worked a lot of second jobs and such, and just lived like very frugally for several years. So it definitely takes a lot of work to make it happen. But we also, like Katie said, like we just kind of sent it. Like we had so many reasons not to do this. You know, one of the big ones was, like, well, why don't we just spend another year in Anchorage before? And why don't we like save up a little bit more money so we have a bigger cushion? And I genuinely think that if we had done that, we would have not done the trip, because the Anchorage school district where we're both employed, it was really hard to get a job this year. We're both blessed that we got a job.
Yeah.
But it was way harder than the previous year. Like, it would have been way harder to quit our jobs like right now than it would have been a year ago. So we're really glad that we did that. And you just have to accept that there's going to be so many reasons not to do it, even when you go do it. Like, there's so many, there will never be a perfect time ever. Like, there will always be a reason. So you just have to see if those reasons that make it not a good time are workable.
Yeah, that's great advice. Great advice from both of you. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, we love talking about this stuff. Yeah, and,
tour, the bike trip itself. It's always fun to like share our story, share our path.
Yeah, and it's a nice way for us to reflect on it too. So we really appreciate you chatting with us.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for this episode of Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz. A big thanks to my guests, Katie Siebert and Ryan Fox. And from all your hosts at Outdoor Explorer, we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.